Hello there. This is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, and on behalf of the entire team, we hope you enjoy the program. This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening. And our main focus today is mission creep in Iraq. Is Erbil in Kurdistan the new Baghdad? Think about it. We have two voices on trying to decipher U.S. policy in Iraq, a policy that seems to now involve ground forces, but with an emphasis on making Kurdistan safe from ISIS, even as Baghdad's political stability and its ability to defend itself seems to be eroding. We'll also give you an update on the unrest in Ferguson, Missouri, the site of that police shooting near St. Louis, and a dinosaur gets a lawyer. That's later this hour. But let's start by trying to get clarity on that precise U.S. mission in Iraq. Is it a rescue mission? Well, the Pentagon says it has helped thousands of Yazidis trapped on top of Mount Sinjar to escape from threats of ISIS. A dozen Marines and special ops forces spent the day helping thousands of Yazidis evacuate earlier this week. Those troops on the ground are performing humanitarian assistance, but Pentagon spokesman Colonel Steve Warren suggests that doesn't preclude other possibilities.
Where exactly the line where it crosses into combat or non-combat, I mean, that's open for debate.
Well, who's debating? Does that jive with this statement from President Obama's National Security Advisor, Ben Rhodes?
We're not putting ground forces into a combat role in Iraq. We're using U.S. military personnel to assess what the best way is to bring people to safety and what the best way is to provide them with humanitarian assistance.
So the U.S. is not putting ground forces into a combat role into unstable and increasingly unfriendly Iraq. But could that just be a cagey way of saying the U.S. is open to putting combat troops into much more friendly Kurdistan? With us now is Aki Peretz, former CIA analyst and co-author of Find, Fix, Finish, Inside the Counterterrorism Campaigns That Killed Bin Laden and Devastated Al-Qaeda. Aki, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me on the show.
So what's the significance of these ground troops? It seems to me it's less about the troops and more about where they are going. This Kurdistan angle seems a little suspicious to me.
Well, it looks like this White House is really bowing to political reality. Iraq is a mess. When ISIS came down and fought the Iraqi army in Mosul, the Iraqi army had a 30-to-1 advantage, and yet they disappeared. So it looks like the Kurds are the only ones really standing up to ISIS, but they really do need help.
And there's oil in Kurdistan, and there's a lot of U.S. business interests in Kurdistan, and it's a relatively peaceful place. And I'm just wondering if we're ditching Baghdad here and maybe taking Erbil on instead.
We might be. I mean, look, Iraqi Kurdistan is really an oasis of pro-American sentiment in a real desert of hostility and anti-Americanism. They all really dislike America and Americans, except for Kurds. Kurds really like us as a country and as a people because we've supported them for the last 20 years.
So we're sending troops into Kurdistan. That at least maintains the fig leaf of the truth that we're not sending ground troops into Iraq.
Well, technically, Iraqi Kurdistan is part of Iraq, and the White House and folks in Congress are really doing a tap dance to sort of justify this. And it's really awkward from a diplomatic perspective. Imagine if Canada bypassed the federal government in D.C. and just negotiated with Florida. It looks bad, but like I said before, it seems that they're trying to bow to political reality because Baghdad is not going to take back their areas anytime soon.
And they're not going to get their political situation resolved anytime soon, and it's a much more stable political situation in Erbil right now.
Correct. They've created a very stable political entity without American intervention in a big way, unlike really the rest of the country.
Is Kurdistan a decent place to create a base for humanitarian operations for the Yazidis? It seems to me the Pentagon and Chuck Hagel's been making signals that suggest they don't necessarily want to do any nation building up in Kurdistan. What's going to happen here?
Well, the Yazidis are ethnically Kurdish, so theoretically they could go there. And the real question is, where else would they go? We're talking about tens of thousands of people who need to go somewhere. Now, whether it's a refugee camp, whether it's sort of to be integrated into the cities themselves, it's unclear. But the whole region is in flames. And where are these Yazidis supposed to go? They're supposed to go to Syria, or they're supposed to go to Turkey or other places. All these countries are really dealing with their own refugee crisis. And to keep these folks sort of generally in the region would probably be best for all involved.
And I'm just wondering, depending on how this militarily comes out, if the U.S. enforces some kind of no-fly zone over Erbil and Kurdistan, if it enforces the border or at least arms the Peshmerga on the border, it's a kind of partition by de facto.
That's probably what the Kurds want. I mean, for the last 100 years or so, they've been looking for their own independent state ever since the end of World War I. And they've been thwarted both by the Iraqis, both by Saddam Hussein, by the current government, and by the folks who preceded Hussein. And they are the closest they've ever been to a real independent state. They have their own flag, they have their own weapons, they have their own borders, and they're being threatened by a real terrorist entity. So they're very close to what they've always wanted to achieve for centuries now.
Aki Paris is a former CIA analyst and co-author of Find, Fix, Finish, Inside the Counterterrorism Campaigns That Killed Bin Laden and Devastated Al-Qaeda. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
So what's this feel like to the Kurds in Erbil right now? Is the U.S. suddenly a more present strategic ally in Kurdistan while the rest of Iraq slips into chaos? An Erbil perspective now from Khalid Saleh, Vice Chancellor for the University of Kurdistan and an advisor to the Prime Minister of Kurdistan.
The city is quiet. People are reassured thanks to the American intervention in the last few days and also the promises of sending weapons so that our forces can confront the threat coming from the ISIS. So people are feeling reassured and they live a normal life now. What they are concentrating on mainly on the streets are helping the incoming refugees as much as they can.
And can the refugees be taken in, the Yazidis be taken in Erbil and in the other areas of Kurdistan?
To make this maybe clear, we have a population of 5 million and we have an influx of 1 million refugees. So the proportion is very big. People are doing whatever they can to make it easy for them. But we have a lot of needs. We have shelter needs. We have psychological health needs. We have transportation needs. A lot of logistics are very difficult to manage.
And Chuck Hagel says that it is less likely that we would undertake any kind of specific humanitarian rescue mission that we have been planning because the siege seems to have been broken. Is that your understanding?
Not as far as I can tell from here, but I don't know exactly what happens in the mountain area. But it is a responsibility to protect. That's what United States stands for. Kurdistan is the only part in which this transition has been successful. So it will be a very, very difficult question if this emerging democracy is lost just because there is no quick intervention by the Americans. The only part of Iraq that's successful and tolerant and looking after the minorities is just this part. And if you don't act at this moment, then you will not be faithful to any of your values.
Is it your understanding and the understanding of the senior leadership in Kurdistan that on some level, whether covert or overt, that there will be a U.S. ground troop peacekeeping force eventually in Kurdistan?
I think this is a moving target because we don't know exactly what will happen next. At this stage, the direct attacks against ISIS forces in some areas helped to ease the pressure. And then the decision to send some weapon and some advisors will also help to coordinate the operations in specific areas that are very urgent to succeed. And also in the long run, if that's needed, that might all depend on exactly what situation we will see.
But let me press you on this. Do you believe, and is it the understanding of senior leadership in Kurdistan, that U.S. ground troops will be defending the border areas of Kurdistan at some point in the future?
I don't think any Kurdish leader will say we need American soldiers here. They say we need American competence. These weapons captured by the ISIS forces were advanced weapons from the Iraqi army. And we can't match them if we don't have enough American expertise how to deal with those weapons and also how to counter them with American weapons. Without that, it will be a lost case for us as well.
So it sounds as though from the perspective of people in Kurdistan that you're a lot closer to becoming an autonomous nation than Baghdad or Basra in the south.
Well, Kurdistan has been autonomous or almost independent of Iraq from 1991 until 2003. With the transition, the Kurds voluntarily rejoined Iraq with the hope that Iraq will function as a decentralized federation. Unfortunately, during that transitional period, some American policymakers forced a centralized administration, and that is the price we are paying now.
So it was a mistake for the U.S. to focus on Baghdad, and the U.S. is realizing that now. And this is going to be a Kurdistan alliance going forward.
I think they should have helped and supported an effective decentralized arrangement. The Kurds should look after their own security. The Sunnis should have looked after their own security. The Shias should have looked after their own security rather than trusting one strong man in Baghdad. And the consequences we have seen has been very, very serious and dire for the whole population, both in Sunni areas and also in Kurdistan. Particularly the vulnerable minorities have paid a very high price for that past policy, unfortunately.
So the U.S., whether it knows it or not, is basically enabling partition here.
I don't think so. I think decentralization is the right word, and also eventually a confederation that will allow these three units to maybe more units to live in peace together without actually any part imposing their worldview, their values, their way of looking at women and minorities so that people can live their lives parallel to each other, not under anyone's domination.
Khalid Saleh, you are a vice chancellor at the University of Kurdistan and a prominent academic. Are we splitting hairs a little bit by saying decentralized versus partition?
No, we are not, because in a decentralized system, you can get a lot of security arrangements located where people are needing their security to be tied. If you impose from any central part of the country your vision, it will not work in a country that's been torn out by so many wars and genocide. You have to remember that Kurds went through a very tough time in the 80s and 90s. They paid a high price for their gains now, and they will do a lot to protect this. So it's not hair splitting.
Then could you name one order that Kurdistan would receive from Baghdad that you would be inclined to follow?
Well, Iraqis, especially the Shias who are now ruling the country somehow in a very strange way, ruling is not the right word, but they have some power. They have to make sure that everyone feels secure within the border of Iraq, including the Sunnis and some other minorities who are so vulnerable. If they can do that, if they allow also oil policies to be decentralized so that different regions can develop in different ways. If also the amount of weapons due to different areas are delivered on time, we wouldn't have seen, for example, this ISIS attack so effective against us. Part of the weapon that was supposed to be given to the Kurds were withheld with Baghdadis, particularly with Maliki, ended up in ISIS hands, unfortunately. So we need to put a mechanism and a process in place whereby the groups are feeling that they are part of the overall Iraq, not subject to any particular order.
Khalid Saleh is vice chancellor for the University of Kurdistan and an advisor to the prime minister of Kurdistan, sounding very much like Kurds want to go it alone, at least with the short term. Khalid Saleh, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We go to the U.S. heartland now, where the aftermath from the police shooting of 18-year-old Michael Brown over the weekend can still be seen on the streets of Ferguson, Missouri, near St. Louis. There were more violent protests last night in a suburb that looks more like a combat zone.
Please continue moving peacefully, as you have been. We want to continue to make this a peaceful event. You must continue moving down West Morrison or Canfield.
Let's get a sense of where things stand. We're joined by Jelani Cobb, a contributor to The New Yorker and director of Africana Studies at the University of Connecticut. So a combat zone, is that an appropriate term? Is that what you would say it looks like in Ferguson?
That is what it looked like last night. You know, what I saw there was very reminiscent of a combat zone.
What is the demeanor between law enforcement and the citizens of Ferguson, and who is attempting to lead and calm people's sort of spirits and passions right now?
I don't think that very much of that is happening, at least not that I've seen on the police side of it. There have been community leaders who have called for peace. The family of Michael Brown has called for peace. I saw some clergy who were out last night. They were playing gospel music, I guess hoping to kind of calm the passions that are running very high right now. But there was a real kind of climate of hostility that was kind of emanating from the police. And it was almost a given. Everyone knew that when night fell, there was going to be some kind of activity that took place.
Is this an open season kind of situation where the incident over the weekend has really brought out a lot of other sort of hidden tensions in Ferguson, a lot of outside agents coming in? Or would you say that it's very much focused on what the police did to Michael Brown?
Yeah, I've heard people saying both of those things. Some people have said that, you know, most of the violence and the anger is from people who don't live in Ferguson proper. But I've also talked with community activists who say that this is something that has roots that go back 10 or 15 years here in terms of, you know, economic underdevelopment and issues in, you know, police and community relationships that have been problematic for a very long time. What I can say is that the veil of secrecy that has surrounded the investigation has done nothing to alleviate the tensions. People think here the secrecy, particularly not releasing the name of the officer, that the secrecy here provides a great deal of leeway, great opportunity for collusion, such that when the name becomes available, people really don't know, you know, whether or not there's been coordination in terms of stories. We heard yesterday that the officer had a swollen face. But there's no way to really verify that, you know, because no one has seen him. No one knows who he is, who he or she is. And so it's very difficult to develop any trust in that context for anything that the police are saying.
And there's no confirmation or even any suggestion that an officer was hospitalized that night.
No. There's no confirmation of this. And, you know, one thing that I have to say that has become, you know, exceedingly obvious here is that, you know, this started out as being an isolated incident or an individual incident here, but now there's been a much broader concern about the militarization of the police force, because last night, you know, the street was blockaded and, you know, the police were out in riot gear, which is, you know, perhaps understandable, you know, given that there have been instances of, you know, looting and some vandalism. And so, you know, they made a blockade across the street and, you know, people have seen that before. But what was atypical and what was shocking to see is that these police officers had two armored personnel carriers that were kind of, you know, nose to nose, that were blocking the street. Many, if not most, of the officers had on some kind of military fatigue garb and helmets. And on top of each of these armored vehicles were, you know, officers who had high-powered assault rifles that were mounted on tripods. And so it really did not seem, you know, the people who were there, you know, protesting, some people peacefully. Admittedly, there were, you know, a handful of people who were yelling provocative things and saying insulting things to the police officers. But in no way did I see this as a situation that warranted people who were in what looked to be like a sniper's nest, you know, two officers that were hunkered down on top of these vehicles with these mounted weapons that, you know, look like something that would be from Iraq or Afghanistan.
Well, on that subject, I mean, do you think this is a coherent top-down policy for trying to restore order in Ferguson, or are the cops just playing Black Hawk Down on some level and nobody's really in control of how this looks?
Well, I think the police believe that order can be imposed from the top down, and that seems to be the strategy. It almost, you know, I wrote in my post for the New Yorker blog that this is kind of like a municipal shock and awe, because even after the crowd dispersed, you know, they ordered the crowd to disperse around 8:30 and began firing tear gas, but they continue to tear gas that community for up to 2 hours after that. Such that there was a large white cloud that was looming over that entire neighborhood. And because of the structure of the neighborhood, because of the layout, if you were in that community at the time that they began tear gassing, you were effectively trapped in it. These were subdivisions where many of the streets looped right back around to the outside or were cul-de-sacs. So you really could not get out of that community once you were in there. And they continued to launch tear gas well after, you know, the crowds had dispersed. They fired rubber bullets. They threw flash grenades. And it was hard to understand what threat justified this.
Jelani, we'll have to see if these tactics, you know, de-escalate tensions in Ferguson. But right now it seems very tense there. Jelani Cobb, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jelani Cobb is a contributor to The New Yorker. Two voices on knowing where your kids are in Baltimore. This is the first full week of a citywide curfew for young people. Off the streets by 10 a.m. for 14 to 16-year-olds, 13 and under indoors by 9. Weekends and summer nights when school's out, you get until 11. It's simple logic, says Baltimore City Councilman Brandon Scott.
If you're going to ask young people to be up and ready for school at 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning, then they should not be out at 11 p.m. at night.
We begin with a voice from inside the mayor's office. Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake believes teens feel valued and cared about if someone is watching to see when they get home on time. Curfews are about caring, not criminalizing teens, says Angela Janice, the director of the mayor's office on criminal justice. Angela, welcome.
Thank you.
You support this curfew, and what are you expecting from it?
I guess first let me begin by saying Baltimore City has had a youth curfew since 1994. So curfew implementation in Baltimore is not new. It has been revised to take into account different times of the year, the school year versus the summer, and different age groups. So as you said, children under 14 have a different curfew from children 14 to 16 who are eligible for work permits. Traditionally, the mayor's office on criminal justice has operated a summer curfew center. We've expanded that approach under the amended curfew to have two connection centers in Baltimore that receive young people who have been picked up in violation of the curfew. Through the connection centers, we are connecting young people and families to supports and services. This past weekend was the first weekend that the connection centers were open, and we had a very positive interaction and feedback from both young people and parents.
You use the term connection center. What is that exactly? It's not a shelter.
It's not a shelter. They're staffed by employees who are youth connectors. These are people who have backgrounds in social work, sociology, criminal justice, or related fields, and who have years of experience working with youth and families.
Is this controversial in Baltimore? Are there advocates and critics who say this won't do anything but raise tensions?
There have been debates. The legislation was first proposed in September and passed in June of this year. And so there were several months of debates about what the curfew was designed to do. Is it criminalizing young people versus providing vulnerable youth with services? Is it increasing contacts between police and young people? And the administration, the mayor, Stephanie Rawlings Blake, and her cabinet are sensitive to those issues, and we've taken steps to ensure that police are receiving trainings on youth development and youth engagement for police officers. The police department is proceeding to have training related to credibility, accountability, and community relations. And so this is an opportunity to continue to improve relationships between the community and the police and to just further improve opportunities for young people across the city.
Are the police enthusiastic about taking on this responsibility? Some call this police parenting.
It's not police parenting. I think, in fact, this weekend we had young people who approached police because they were in vulnerable situations. One young person approached the police because he had missed his bus and he needed a way to get home. Two young people approached the police because they were, in fact, locked out of their home. And so this is an opportunity to connect young people. And having been in the centers this summer and last summer and to see young people who come in between the hours of 9 p.m. and 4 a.m., you do not want your children to be unsupervised in the streets of Baltimore or any city between those hours. And so this is an opportunity for us to keep our young people safe, to involve them in positive activities, and also, again, I know I've repeated it endlessly, but to connect them to services and supports. So this is about helping our young people.
Angela Janice is director of the Mayor's Office on Criminal Justice. Thanks so much, Angela.
Thank you for having me.
And now a curfew skeptic. Jason Tichet has long experience working with Baltimore's youth. He's a juvenile justice director at the nonprofit Advocates for Children and Youth. Tichet says a curfew raises tensions in neighborhoods, gives more responsibility to police that they might not want, and generally poisons the atmosphere between teens and law enforcement.
I think curfews are well-intended but ultimately misguided forms of social policy. They assume that all children at a certain age, at a certain time of day, are doing either something wrong or are in need of social services. And there's no data out there anywhere in the country that says that's the case. There's no reason why a child out past what's going to be 9 o'clock now on a Thursday night needs social services or is about to commit a crime.
What about the logic of getting up for school at 6:37 in the morning? They need to be in bed before 11 or indoors before 10.
Sure. And I think a popular refrain here during this debate for the proponents of the curfew has been nothing good happens after 9 o'clock. And that very well might be true. But that doesn't mean that a citywide curfew with police being the intermediary is the solution to that problem.
Although it sounds like the mayor is suggesting that parents have really dropped the ball here in certain neighborhoods and that kids are unsupervised at that time and that this is really the only remedy.
Well, if that's true, it should be pointed out that Baltimore already has a curfew. This new curfew is simply an expansion of what we've already had. And you heard from the proponents again and again and again that they were tired of seeing kids out at 1, 2, and 3 in the morning. Well, if that's the case, we already had a law in the books that said they needed to be inside by midnight. So if it wasn't working then, I fail to see how this new plan is going to be any different. It's like looking for a needle in a haystack and then adding more hay to the pile.
In the debate over this curfew amendment, was law enforcement enthusiastic about taking on this responsibility?
There was a bifurcation in law enforcement. Leadership was in favor, but when the debate originally came up last fall, the line cops came out in opposition, but in form of the union. So I think there's perhaps some debate in the police department.
What would you say is the downside of kids having contact with police over curfew violations? Is there a kind of stop and frisk impact in the sense that kids are picked up for basically just being on the street?
Sure. I think that's a legitimate concern that a lot of folks have here in the city, especially in either minority or economically disadvantaged communities, because they tend to have a tenser relationship with the police. And now the cops have pretense to stop anyone that they believe looks under a certain age. And that could lead to searches, it could lead to warrant checks, it could lead to any number of forms of heightened police contact with this population that otherwise wouldn't have been there.
Is that age profiling or racial profiling?
Well, it's going to be hard to decipher that. I mean, both are very hard to track. I think, though, in Baltimore City, our under 18 population is about 70% African American, but our juvenile detention center here in the city is 99% Black. So there's very clearly a disproportionate racial contact within the criminal justice system and our juvenile population in Baltimore City.
Is your mission to have police have fewer interactions with young African-Americans in Baltimore? Or, you know, I'm just wondering what the alternative is here.
Well, I think the first thing to realize is that police have a really important job, especially in a place like Baltimore City. And one of those jobs is not to be a social worker. And so this is, again, I think a part of that misguided nature of the curfew is we can have police be police or we can try to have them fill this role of social worker, which is not what they're trained for and not the best allocation of their time. The problem with this curfew is that the next step and supposedly what the mayor hopes to be the evolution of curfew in Baltimore City are these youth connection centers where instead of the police taking a child home on account of a curfew violation, they take them farther away from their home to one of two centers in the city that will supposedly connect them with the services that they allegedly need.
Jason Tichet is the Juvenile Justice Director at Advocates for Children and Youth, a nonprofit dedicated to improving the lives of Maryland's children, talking about the new curfew in Baltimore City. Thanks, Jason.
Thank you.
We want to hear where you stand on this issue. Do you think curfews can ever be a good idea in a city? Or is it not the role of police to keep young people off the streets? Call us at 877-8-MY-TICK. This next story, you might say, is sort of a cross between Jurassic Park and, if you can believe it, L.A. Law. A discovery of one of the greatest paleontological finds in history, a nearly complete Tyrannosaurus rex. The story begins 24 years ago when the research team at the Black Hills Institute of Hill City, South Dakota, made one of the greatest finds in history, the largest, most nearly complete Tyrannosaurus rex skeleton ever found. This T-Rex was named Sue for Sue Hendrickson, who stumbled upon the first bits of bone and paid $5,000 to cart the skeleton off the property. But the T-Rex soon found itself threatened by Western land lawyers, creatures not around when this T-Rex lived. Peter Larson is a paleontologist and president of the Black Hills Institute. He's the subject of a new documentary, Dinosaur 13. Larson says in ancient times, T-Rex may have been at the top of the food chain, but it had no defense for the state marshals who arrived one day without warning.
It happened on August 12th, 1990, and we were working at a duckbill dinosaur quarry. And Susan Hendrickson took a walk and brought back some pieces of a dinosaur that just some chunks of vertebra. And when I saw him, I knew it was going to be a T-Rex just by the texture of the bone and the open spaces that you could see because of the invasion of the air sacs. And from the moment I saw that dinosaur on the ground, I knew it was the most fantastic thing that we'd ever have the chance of working on.
So we're not talking about rocks here. We're talking about actual bones preserved.
Actual bone. One of the things that people don't – in fact, paleontologists didn't understand until just a little while ago, and some paleontologists still don't understand that we have so much more of that original material that was the animal preserved, not just the bone, which is hydroxyl apatite or calcium phosphate, but also some of the soft tissue preserved as well.
That's amazing. So how much of this T-Rex was there?
We have between 75 and 80% of the bones preserved, which is pretty awesome. It's still the most complete Tyrannosaurus rex that's ever been found, as well as the largest and best preserved.
Any idea why she ended up in that cliff face?
She died in a stream bed and was rapidly buried, which is how she's preserved. But there's really strong evidence to show that she was actually killed by another Tyrannosaurus rex. Now, when you think of her as the largest of all the Tyrannosaurus rex specimens that's ever been found to date, and you think something killed her, was another T-Rex, was that T-Rex bigger or just perhaps stronger or maybe a little younger, because she's also the oldest T-Rex that we found. So she abdicated her throne, but not willingly.
How old was she?
She was at least 28 years old. We know that from what are called lines of arrested growth, sort of like tree rings in her bones. Right. But if she ceased growth, she might have actually been older than that when she died.
Now, it's an old story in the West, you know, open land, somebody's poking around and, you know, you find oil or gold or something like that, and suddenly the owner of the land needs to know about what it is that you found. In this particular case, you had something of value to paleontologists, but the location of this dinosaur had some sort of legal entanglements.
Yeah, of course, we as paleontologists have to be very careful of what land we're on, so we have permission to be there, first of all, and then beyond permission to be there, actually permission to do excavations, because you're disturbing the surface of the land when you're excavating.
And you had all that, right?
We had all that. We had permission from Morris Williams first to explore, and then once we found the dinosaur, first we double-checked with the courthouse that he did indeed own that site before we moved anything, and then told Morris Williams what we would like to do and asked for his permission to dig, and he said we could. We actually had to could only go into the site one time to load it out, so we had to actually walk into the site from his brother's property about a mile away, carry in all of our equipment, and then work the cliff face down to extract the dinosaur.
T-Rexes are at the top of the food chain, right?
Absolutely. They're an active predator that pretty much ate whatever they wanted.
And you discovered that, in fact, there is a predator for the T-Rex a few hundred million years in the future.
Somebody called me and said, the FBI's got crime scene tape around the Institute and they've taken Sue. I hung up the phone and I went as fast as I could down to the Institute. I don't know how many agents they had, 30-some people or whatever. It was just insane. I didn't even think about it. I grabbed the tape and go under it. I just went to the specimen. That was my concern. I could just see these idiots, you know, try to pack up my dinosaur and take it away and ruin it.
Now, that's from this film, Dinosaur 13, and it tells the story of the FBI coming and getting this fossil.
Well, you heard Terry Wentz's voice. Terry was the main preparator of Sue's skeleton. So we had her out of the ground. We had been working on her for 20 months, and I got up in the morning, and the whole place was surrounded with FBI agents, 35 FBI agents, people from the Forest Service, people from the National Park Service. They said that we had collected Sue on federal land against a violation of the Antiquities Act, which incidentally was declared unconstitutionally vague in 1974. So here we are in 1990, and apparently the acting U.S. Attorney Kevin Schieffer had decided that this would be a great publicity stunt.
And sorting this out was really the big question here. Listen.
It was discovered within the exterior boundaries of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe on land which was held in trust for the benefit of Maurice Williams, the landowner. It wasn't tribal land, it wasn't federal land. It was a really, Sioux came out from an absolute legal netherworld.
I mean, Sioux sort of describes the netherworld here. You've got the Sioux tribe, you've got the dinosaur, and you paid $5,000 for the fossil originally to Maurice Williams.
That's correct.
But that didn't clarify things at all here. What's Patrick Duffy, the attorney for your Black Hills Institute, talking about here?
Yeah, Sioux was actually found on land that Maurice Williams had. I don't remember if he had purchased it or traded for it, but he owned the land. But he put the title in trust with the United States government. And I actually grew up on the Rosebud Reservation. This is the Cheyenne Reservation where we're collecting them. And I thought I understood the system. But the system is so complicated. And the complication here was that land was put in trust. The title was held by the federal government for the benefit of Maurice Williams. And it had a tremendous effect on what happened to that dinosaur.
And I mean, you said that they – accused you of violating an Antiquities Act, but there were a lot of charges here eventually, and the prosecutors were determined to take this to court.
Yeah, eventually, through a long-time investigation that involved three different grand juries, we were indicted on 39-count, 153-charge indictment. And we had went through the longest criminal trial in South Dakota history. I was convicted of two felony counts for which I served 2 years in prison. And
went to jail?
I went to prison. I went to Florence, Colorado, federal prison, same prison where John Gotti and Timothy McVeigh were. I was in the minimum security. They were in supermax, but it was the same prison complex.
Is there a happy ending?
There's definitely a happy ending. Our business, Black Hills Institute, is not only still in business, but we're thriving. Sioux is in a happy place, and anybody can go see her. She's at the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago.
The home of dinosaurs everywhere. And Maurice Williams, the late Maurice Williams, who cashed your $5,000 check, he also had a pretty happy outcome regarding the Field Museum. He sold Sioux,
yeah,
Sioux
was
more than $8 million.
Sioux was sold at auction, yeah. He ended up with a lot of money, which because it was proceeds of a trust, was tax-free. But I don't think he was ever a very happy individual, unfortunately. And so I'd much rather be me than him.
Peter Larson, paleontologist and president of the Black Hills Institute, which is the subject of the new documentary Dinosaur 13, directed by Todd Miller. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Dinosaur 13, which tells that convoluted story of Sue the T-Rex, opens in limited release tomorrow. And if you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the show, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.